Hello, and welcome to Getting to Know Your Friends. I'm your host, Zach Rowland, and today we have a very, very, very special guest, Kevin Mullaney. Thank you for coming. I always give my guests a little one-person applause whenever they get on this show. So
that's usually
thanks for coming.
The number of people who applaud it at the same time.
Oh, yeah. Just the one single guy.
One person.
I know him. So Kevin, wow, I'm just, this is great. Like, I'm super excited to have you on the show and get to know you a lot more. I've kind of gotten to know you a little bit through working with you with improv, but I want to know, like, where you've come from and what all you've done and the fun life things that you've done. And so let's just start off with where are you originated at?
Well, actually, I was, well, I did wasn't born in Kansas City. I was born in outside of Chicago.
Okay.
Lived briefly as a youngster, as a toddler in Kansas City.
And oh, you did?
Grew up in a little town from like age five on. Grew up in a little town in Peoria called Morton, Illinois.
Okay, Morton. So my stepfather's from Streeter. Are you familiar with Streeter?
Just by name.
Yeah.
It's, you know, that's by Pontiac, tight. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's sort of on the way to Chicago from where I lived.
Yeah. Cool, cool. So so you were mostly Chicago person. I mean, you lived outside of it, but then...
Well, yeah, pretty far out. I mean, it's 3 hours away, so I didn't really... you know, I visited Chicago as a kid, but I didn't live in Chicago. I went to University of Illinois.
And that's in...
Champaign-Urbana. Which is also about 2.5 hours away from Chicago.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good time. I enjoyed school.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's probably where things changed for me, radically changed for me. Because when I was a kid, I was one of those really sort of, I don't know what the right, I was a smart kid. I was very good at math and science.
Okay.
I did like math and science competitions, you know, played chess, all that kind of stuff. I wasn't like a complete geek, nerd, whatever. I don't know. I mean, you know, like I played sports and other things too. But I was a very smart kid.
You were. I think you were like well rounded. I really think like
maybe, but I didn't like. I mean, I didn't study English. I was not involved in the arts.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
I mean, I took the bare minimum English classes in high school, and then when I went to college, I got in on this program where it was really easy for me to get in any class I wanted because I was able to sign up for things early as an honor student. And so that first year at U of I, I took a filmmaking class and I took a poetry class along with my chemical engineering classes. And it was probably, you know, midway through the first term when I hatched this plan to switch to become an English major with a cinema studies minor, and then I would become a great film director after college.
Yeah.
And
Scorsese.
Yeah. Well, the problem was is that at the time, the U of I had this was 25 years ago. At the time, U of I didn't really have a program. I mean, the cinematography program was a set of small classes in the visual arts department where they had a couple 16mm cameras and you know, it's nothing like what I see today where I'll work with a college group on a film,
right,
and they'll have 20 people crewing and they'll have grips and lights and multiple camera shoots and everybody seems to actually know what they're doing. You know, it was nothing like that. It was like just some this one guy who used to be a cinematographer who said, here's the camera, go figure it out. So I didn't really get much practical experience in college. It was just more sort of stoking the desire.
It's kind of interesting how throughout, you know, time we can kind of see that with different programs. Because I mean, like, you know, I'm a little bit younger and I went to the University of Kansas, but I remember like in the film department there already being this kind of like larger outreach to the world with the equipment that they had, with how they were filming. Like you were saying, there's 20 people on a project. But knowing also that, like, one time there were people going to LA, doing a job, and then going back to maybe, like, their hometown and teaching for that university or teaching for that one place that they wanted to do. And so now with the internet and everything that we have, people are so knowledgeable about that. And the programs have just burst open with that kind of stuff. So it's almost intimidating, I feel like, nowadays. I don't know. Could you do it now, you think, if you really wanted to? Would you get back into it?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I try to do some film projects here and there, but it's one of those things where the learning curve is a bit high for me right now, and I don't have the time to do it. I wish, you know, I think it would have been a very different experience for me if at the time I had access to digital cameras and Final Cut Pro when I was 20 years old.
Yeah.
I would have been making films every weekend, or probably every day. I would have been out shooting and doing stuff. You know, if I had the equipment I have today, I have a nice Canon camera that shoots for really nice HD video, and I've got good mics and all this stuff. Like I could have created, but I just don't have the time or I have all this other projects I'm working on and all this other focus. So, but I think it's a totally different experience. The kinds of things that people mounted. Mm-hmm. Or are mounting today, it's still expensive, and you know these people are spending $10,000-$20,000 to create their thesis film for college or whatever. But in my day, you know those budgets were like that or more, but it was all film.
Yeah,
like so we've managed to eliminate the cost of film. Wow. And these projects because it's all digital.
Interesting.
And I think even the cameras are cheaper and stuff. You know, a Canon, you know, you couldn't get a decent 16mm camera for $700 or whatever. Like you can get a good digital HD camera now for under $1,000.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a very different experience.
Incredible. So, all right. So then you took off from there, right? You went after
I decided to... I spent a year abroad in London and I started doing theater while I was there.
Yeah.
They called it the Drama Society. It was basically a club attached to the student union.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't a program. Again, I was studying English but then doing this drama stuff on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I sort of caught more of the theater bug than the film bug.
Yeah.
And I decided after I was going to graduate from college, I was going to finish up with my English degree, and then I was going to go to Chicago, become an actor, and then go off and do my MFA somewhere as an actor.
Yeah.
That was the plan. So I switched my MFA in directing film to MFA in acting.
Uh-huh.
And, now it's 20 years later, and...
Yep.
And
where's the MFA, right?
No MFA.
Yeah.
Which I don't think I've suffered very much from not having, but...
I agree.
But yeah, it's very different. Turns out very differently than I thought.
Yeah. I began as a theater major in acting. I was in rehearsal one day doing a high school play, Rainmaker, and playing the adult father figure because I was the only person that could grow a beard at the time at the age of 18. And
very useful.
Yes, yes.
College theater departments.
Yeah, yeah. And my director stopped the rehearsal, and I just like, this will ever be forever ingrained in my memory. She stopped the rehearsal. We were just going at it, and she looked up at me, and she's like, "What are you going to college again for?" And I said, "Technical theater." At the time, I was big into technical theater. I wanted to learn lights and sound, and I was building sets, and I had looked into joining up with the set building union. I can't remember now what they call it or whatever. Is it SAG? No, that's acting. That's stupid.
That's SAG.
Yeah. You can clearly see I am nowhere near any of that. Likewise, I have no idea of what any of that stuff really is. But she looked at me and she's like, "Don't do that. Go be an actor. You know, you may like technical stuff."
Boy, she fucked you over.
Man. Yeah, right? Yeah.
Go back in time
really
and be like...
She really did.
No, like...
Yeah.
Learn something practical.
Right. No, I just like, God, I'm like, why did you tell me that? So I took off, you know, took off and went and studied at the University of Kansas and started off in acting. And my first semester there, I didn't do any acting. I didn't do a single acting class. All of it was gen eds. And I thought to myself, well, if this is college, then fuck this. Like, I don't want to just do, and I wanted to act, you know, I wanted to get into it. And unfortunately, I fell into the relationship whole and started getting more into my relationship than actually finding myself as a human being, and did not lead me to London, although I wish it would have, because I've always had a desire to study with these amazing people that, you know, especially in London and
well, the great thing about the London thing was it wasn't, I mean, I don't know if it was great exactly. There was no program. It was...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was... I mean, there was, but the program was, we have a black box theater that we can do 30 shows in 30 weeks in, and who wants to direct a show? The people with the least experience, i.e. the person who has never directed before, gets top priority.
Wow.
So, and, you know, most people could do, if they really were motivated, they could do two shows a year, but it was it was a different person every week, different play, you know, and it just, whatever what you wanted to do was fine. You know, you could, I directed a Pinter play. I directed The Homecoming as my, the first thing, my first foray into directing, which was... the Homecoming, I directed it in London with English actors, which is insane.
Yeah,
it's just insane to think that at age 19, I knew what I was doing, that I could direct, know enough about a Pinter and East End of London to direct this play.
And for those listening, can you kind of go into Pinter and...
Sure,
and
so Pinter was... and is a writer, an English writer. He started in the 50s, I believe, and he's known for he was kind of known for this absurdist style. This very his plays had the veneer of being very realistic, but they would have absurd elements and sort of, you know, characters behaving in what seemed like somewhat irrational ways or flurries of sort of expressionistic dialogue that was built into it. Very intense plays that he wrote. And very much about East End, not always, but very often about characters who are from the East End who spoke with a Cockney accent.
with
stuff I didn't know. I mean, for example, there was a guy... In the cast, I cast a guy from New Zealand as one of the brothers in The Homecoming. The brother who's a boxer. I think his name is Joey, and I thought he was doing great in rehearsal. He was acting well. I didn't have a problem with his performance at all. And one of the English actors came up to me and said, "Are we going to do anything about his accent?" And I'm like, "What do you mean?" It's like he's got a New Zealand accent. He doesn't sound English at all. And to my ear, it was like, you know, my 19-year-old ear, it didn't bother me. I don't know. I'm sure I could tell, but it just didn't bother me. Like, that seems fine to me. And I was like, "Okay, you work with him," and he worked with him, and I'm sure it was a terrible accent wise. Yeah. But it was one of those things, it didn't matter to me, but I'm doing this in London with English actors.
And they're really into, like they want to
make sure. Anybody who would see it any English student who would see it would be like, "What is going on with that guy's accent? Why is the younger brother from New Zealand in this play?" And
Yeah, that's funny. I got cast as an accent once I can't even remember, it was a 10-minute play. I always felt like I was doing it wrong, and somebody was going to hear it and go, "That's not the right accent, buddy."
I hate working with accents. I hate it.
Yeah, I knew I wasn't fit for the part necessarily, but a friend of mine was directing it, and he's like, "Well, you're funny, so I'd like to see you put some humor into this role, because we've had nobody come in and audition." Yeah, he called me into audition, and you know, he's like, "Yeah, I like it, let's do it." And I looked nothing like what I thought the part would be like. So
yeah,
that's awesome. So you were 19, you're already directing. That's awesome, because I also...
That was the thing. That year I directed, I did lighting design, I did, I produced a show that went to Edinburgh.
Oh, yeah. Fringe Fest, right?
The Edinburgh Fringe Fest. Yeah. So I've been to the Edinburgh Festival maybe, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4 times.
Oh, that's so great. I would just love to go over there and experience. I've heard so many amazing things about the Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
It's fun. It's a lot. It's boot camp for the entertainment industry, because you go and you have a show and you have to figure out how to get people to see your show. You have to figure out how to get the press to see your show, and it's just this pressure cooker for three weeks. And the stakes, you know, I mean, there's not like a huge number of people who launch their careers from it, but you can certainly build something quite nice in Edinburgh. The, like, to use an example, Baby Wants Candy.
Mm-hmm.
Went my third year, I went as sort of along. I wasn't in Baby Wants Candy, but I was sort of consulting. I was like a consulting producer or something.
Oh yeah,
like hanging out with them and telling them my experience and how what we had to do to get people to come see us shows and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And
Baby Wants Candy, I'm sorry, is a group from Chicago.
They're an improv group from Chicago who does improvised musicals.
Yes.
Currently in New York, in Chicago, and in L.A.
Yeah.
And back then, they were just a team at I.O. In Chicago. And so they did really well that first year. After a few nights, they were selling out in a maybe 100-seat theater.
Mm-hmm.
And so it became this thing where, you know, they paid... it became a thing where... I don't think the people who go over and do that show, they've gone like six or seven times now, maybe more. I don't think the people who do that show make a lot of money. They probably don't make hardly anything. But they get 3 weeks in Edinburgh, all expenses paid. They have a great time. They perform with... they usually recruit a Scottish rock cover band to be the group, to provide the music.
Wow. Yeah.
So, and there's definitely a host of success stories where people go and parlay it somehow into a career. There's a guy, Rich Fulcher, who's a fairly well-known comic in England.
Mm-hmm.
And he's an American. He's from Chicago. And his first trip to Britain was at the Fringe Festival with an improv show.
Mm-hmm.
And that show did so well that...
Go ahead, yeah. No. Allergies, guys. They're terrible. Yeah. It's that time of year, too, when spring and summer, they all meet together.
It's right in the middle of my Fulcher story. So,
the Fulcher story.
Yeah, Fulcher is part of a group show called Modern Problems in Science.
Mm-hmm.
It became sort of a hit at Edinburgh, and he parlayed that. into a stand-up career in England, and he's been on a number of television shows there, and he's well known there.
Yeah,
even though he's only sort of not quite as famous in the U.S. But
right, I almost feel like it's, I don't know, with the whole U.S. situation. I mean, I'm not even in a tier of that at all. But looking at the levels of fame and stardom and success and what you want to consider it does seem like it's different in other places than America. Like in America, it's very, I don't know, it's still like an American dream, you know, like you do this thing which leads to this thing which leads to this thing, it means you're famous, and mm-hmm. and it's like, okay, but that's not necessarily, I feel like, how it is anywhere else. And maybe I'm just disillusioned to it because I haven't been outside of the United States, but how was that? I mean, is that kind of how that felt over there, or is it more like... Because I feel like it's more or less the craft there.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that it's probably changed a bit, but, you know, for years and years, most of the acting training or a lot of the very best acting training in the United States took place outside of universities.
Mm.
You know, it took place at the Neighborhood Playhouse in New York.
Yeah.
And the what's his name? The Method Strasberg studio.
Yeah.
And the theater they came from.
Yeah.
But anyway, so there's been this tradition of kind of outsider schools that, you know, sometimes would become accredited and affiliated with colleges, but often were just a guy teaching in a studio or a woman teaching in a studio somewhere. That is not the case in England. It was always these very these conservatory programs that were much more like going to college. And the upshot of that, in part, was that you really couldn't get acting jobs in England very mm-hmm. much unless you'd gone through one of the major conservatories. That was my impression, at least. Whereas in America, you just show up for the audition, and so there's this. In general, the American actor is viewed as having fewer skills in general, and not as well trained.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, there's a lot of really well-trained actors in America, but mm-hmm. but like, you know, you can go to an audition and there's somebody from Juilliard and there's somebody from Yale and there's somebody who just took an 8-week class at the acting garage in Toledo, you know.
So, yeah.
And the guy from the acting garage in Toledo might get the part because he looks like it.
Right.
You know, that, yeah. that's how the part looks, you know.
Yeah.
That was less so in England. The other thing was you got the sense there were a lot of actors who made a living, made a comfortable living, but there were fewer, the sort of superstar mentality of Hollywood.
Right.
You know, there weren't people making, there were very few English actors that came close to making millions and millions of dollars, unless they moved to Hollywood.
Sure.
You know, the actors,
and they could get a deal.
Get that if they got themselves in Hollywood movies, but so it was much more sort of like a career, not a quest for fame kind of thing. I get, you know,
yeah,
similar to like how I'm paycheck. Sure there's Broadway actors and plenty of television actors in the United States who reach that level of
yeah.
They're making a good living, but it's they're not really that famous.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're not they're certainly not paid extreme amounts of money.
Right. Yeah. The starving artist thing really does.
But that changes. I think that changes the pursuit of it. You know, you have if there isn't a when there is a level of there are a limited number of people who are going to be making, you know, who might make $50 million on a mm-hmm. on one movie, then you're going to have lots more people who sort of want to do it just for that reason, to
right.
be super famous and to be super rich. Whereas, mm-hmm. you don't. That's not why you get into acting, I think, in England. You don't become an actor to become super rich and super famous
yes.
because you don't. There's no... That yeah. doesn't happen
yeah.
as
yeah.
much. You know?
Yeah. I think that speaks leagues of the talent... And the training and the professionalism.
Yeah. Well, and also just the size. I mean, the size of the industry yeah. there is different. And,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah. So you were there for a year then?
Yeah, and so I know all about it because
yeah.
I was there for a year when
yeah.
I was 19. And so
sure,
therefore
yeah,
I know
you lived
everyone.
It. Yeah, so what was next?
Then I moved to Chicago. Well, I went back after college for another 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Then I moved to Chicago, started doing improv, started doing acting.
Yeah.
Well, after a couple of years, got involved at I.O.
Okay.
What
took you from that? You said because you went to directing, and then you went.
Well,
to...
I was acting in college, and that was really by the time I left college, I wanted to be an actor.
Yeah,
and that was my first choice. Was I wanted to be an actor, probably on stage, maybe on film,
mm-hmm.
and so I moved to Chicago, and I looked, you know, where are the cities to go to if you want to learn how to become an actor?
Right.
And Chicago's near the top of that list.
Yeah.
So, and it was the closest place, and
mm-hmm.
New York seemed super scary to me. Not super scary, but super unpleasant to
yeah.
me.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a time.
Well, and also, I had visited New York, but I hadn't really visited the neighborhoods where people really live in New York.
Yeah.
You know, I sort of, the one time I had visited, it was like the Financial District and Times Square. And if that's the two places you see in New York, it's like, why would you ever live here? This is horrible.
Yes.
And this is also Times Square in 1989, not Times Square.
Completely different.
Which is very different.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Pre-Giuliani.
Yeah. Or the,
yeah.
near the beginning of his reign.
Yes.
But, so I didn't like what I saw in New York, and I didn't think L.A. would be a place I'd want to go.
Mm-hmm.
I thought of other places like San Francisco and Seattle are supposed to be good places. Minneapolis is supposed to be a good place
mm-hmm.
For theater, but it just seemed like Chicago was a good choice.
Cool.
So I went there, started studying acting.
Yeah.
Started taking improv classes because everybody takes improv classes in Chicago.
Yeah, yeah. The Mecca.
And then just got sucked more into that than into... I think it was more... It wasn't so much that I liked it more. It was that there were more... You know, it was harder to get opportunities to act
mm-hmm.
than it was to get to do improv.
Yeah.
And so I was getting a lot of it opportunities to improvise
mm-hmm.
and was getting better, faster at that than I was at acting in general.
Right, yeah.
So I just ended up an improviser more than an actor.
Awesome. Yeah. Now, at the same time, I also know, or at least throughout like the sprinkled history, you also led another life. You led an online life, right? As soon as the whole concept of Second Life came to
fruition. Well, I talked a little bit about this. I don't talk a lot about this because it's kind of like this weird alter.
Sure.
I think what's interesting and fun about Second Life is unlike Facebook or Twitter, or especially in the Facebook age, it harkens back to a time in the internet where you could become a persona and be that persona. And I liked that internet a lot better. I like the internet where you were a different, you know, you could be on 20 different websites and there was no interaction between them. It's sort of like, you know, people will talk about this, like, if you're into some sort of geeky subculture, like you're into comic, you know, some comic books or computer programming or something that might have a online community.
Right.
You know, you could join that online community as a 13-year-old and be treated as an equal with 40-year-olds, and not because they don't know your gender unless you tell them. They don't know your age unless you tell them.
Yep.
And most people don't ask, and most people don't care.
Yeah.
And so, and that was true in Second Life too, where it was just this place where you can just be whatever you want to be.
Yeah.
And the other thing was I have participated in various MMOs over the years, going back to college, in pre-internet MMOs, essentially, on the college computer system at U of I. And I've always been interested in them, and I had spent a few years playing World of Warcraft and wanted to stop playing World of Warcraft.
Oh, yeah.
And so rather
recovery.
Well, I knew that the way I work is the way to break an addiction is to replace it with another one.
Sure.
So I started looking around for something else to do,
and
Second Life was... the nice thing about Second Life was instead of doing a bunch of mindless quests, or, you know, that you actually could go in there and learn things. You could learn programming. You could learn, sharpen your skills as in Photoshop. And if you made something worthwhile, you could get paid for it.
Yeah.
So I wasn't really going in there to make a living or anything. I was just a curiosity for me. But I ended up creating some scripted devices that became pretty good sellers. And I lived off that income for 3 or 4 years from selling things in Second Life.
Yeah, that's cool. I think I love that, the whole idea of having another persona, and kind of having it be more anonymous. You know, like not having to worry so much about the judgment of people that you interact with daily or any of that. It's like you get to live that other
life. Well, yeah. There's no like anyone who, for the most part, you left people's personal lives to themselves. And you got to know them. I felt like you actually got to know people in a very intimate way.
Yeah.
At least some people. I made a few friends that I got to know very, very well. And, you know, I would be in Second Life working 10, 12 hours a day sometimes.
Oh, wow.
And they would be as well, and we would be chatting off and on that entire time. It's sort of like, it's a lot like having a texting relationship with somebody, but it was even more intense. You know, I realized there were people who, in 4 or 5 weeks, I spent more time with than maybe people I'd known for years.
Yeah, that's crazy. You got
to know them really well without knowing their name or knowing really where they lived or how their age or their gender or whatever.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. But you like them, and you work with them, or you do those things. And
there would be people from totally different, you know, you get to know people from other countries, or so they said. it's sort of, it's funny to me, like, this whole catfishing thing.
Yes.
Because, like, Second Life is a catfish bonanza, you know what I mean, essentially.
Yeah, anybody can be anybody.
Anybody can be anybody. But I think anybody who's spent enough time in there starts to realize, like, oh, I don't care anymore. Like, I don't care who you say you are.
Yeah.
I don't care who you are in real life. I'm never going to meet you in real life. I don't need to ever see a picture of you.
Right.
We have a connection, you know, that's purely intellectual and purely about keys on a keyboard, and I don't care about anything else about you. So it's sort of like, I guess I would never I would be so skeptical of any, like, if there was anybody I wanted to meet in real life, like, through a website or whatever that I met online, I guess I would never be shocked that they would not be who they were. And I'd never be like, how dare you be 10, 20 pounds heavier than I thought you were based on your photo. Because it was just like, because people would represent themselves as completely other people.
Yeah, or maybe other, even like other colors, right?
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, like people were totally, you know, like, white people pretending to be black people and vice versa. Yeah. And,
well, didn't they have like blue people on there? Wasn't there kind of like a... Well,
sure, yeah, and half the people were dressed as you know, like come half fox, half person, and... You know, there's a furry thing that was happening. Now there were people who would go around dressed as dragons the whole time.
Yeah,
you know, sort of like like how could I be angry at you? Like you're not a dragon in real life,
right? You know? How dare you for falsifying who you?
You know, or you're not a member of Starfleet or whatever else. It was all role playing. You know, people were deciding who they wanted to be and exploring that. So it was fun.
Yeah, I like that. I like that, you know, you have, like, that hobby. You know, you moved on from one, like you said, move on from one hobby to another hobby or one habit to another habit. And, yeah, that's, like, that moment where you find the next fun thing in your life and you work with that.
And I felt that was a healthy one, a one where I learned things. And
yeah, definitely. So then, and just to jump ship off of that, then also I know that you're a poker player, and you've done some.
Sorry.
Yeah, you're good. You've done some hardcore poker playing, and So, like, what was that experience like?
Well, I played as a kid. You know, played crazy, strange games as a kid, and this was. This was years before the poker boom in the U.S., you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we would, I guess, I played, you know, poker as a kid like a lot of people do. And then when I was an adult, actually it was when I moved to New York.
Mm-hmm.
I had found out from my sisters that my father was playing a lot of casino poker. At the time, this was Limit Hold'em he was playing. And he came to visit me, and I think my sisters were worried about him gambling his life savings away.
My grandfather's doing the same exact thing right now.
And so I talked to him about it. I asked him about it, and he decided that he was going to take me to a casino.
Mm-hmm.
And I find out years later his agenda was he was going to take me to a casino, give me $100, let me play poker, let me lose, and then I would never want to play poker again in a casino.
Oh. That's similar to how the smoking story goes. You know, like they catch you smoking, they make you smoke all those cigarettes so they...
Make you sick.
Yeah. Interesting.
So, it backfired. It gave me $100, $200 to play with, something like that. And I won money the first day.
Mm-hmm.
Then we went to another casino the next day. I won money the second day.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was convinced that I had some natural ability at poker.
Yeah.
Which was... It was basically just I listened well to his advice. He coached me, told me the basic strategy.
Oh, cool.
You know, that he followed.
Yeah.
And I just... I got lucky, and it's just conservative. It's like you only play good cards, and... Excuse me. You only continue if your cards fit with what's going on the board.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't very complicated what he explained to me.
Sure. But it worked.
Yeah, and it was a lot of luck. I mean, it doesn't matter what your strategy is. If you play long enough, you'll have streaks where you win.
Oh, yeah.
So I went home, and I found, you know, back then, I can't remember what the site was. It was Paradise Poker, I think.
Yeah,
was the first site I played on.
Mm-hmm.
I played on Paradise Poker.
I played on Paradise as well.
Some other... thing, you know, this other place where you could play poker for just play money.
Mm-hmm.
We went to met some friends in Las Vegas, played poker there.
Yeah.
I got really serious for a while, and I read a lot of books, and mm-hmm. I was probably 4 or 5 months into it and started sort of calculating how much money I was making, because I was making money.
Oh yeah.
And it came out to like, I'm making $2 an hour. I was like, okay. I'm not going to continue doing this, making $2 an hour. So I gave it up. And then years later, it came up again, and I was playing with friends and starting to go to casinos. And then around the time that I was getting involved in Second Life, I was also playing online very seriously.
Oh, yeah.
And for a period, I was doing much better. I was making...
like $4 an hour?
No. I mean, I was making... there were a few months before I left New York where I was making $3,000 or $4,000 a month.
Oh, wow.
Which, you know, that's livable if you could consistently make that.
Absolutely.
Especially if you could live wherever the hell you wanted.
Right, know? Right.
So I went out to Phoenix with my dad, and we spent the winter in Phoenix, in Scottsdale, going to the same casino every day and playing poker every day in those casinos with the retirees and real estate dudes who played poker in those casinos every day. So I did that for like 6 months, thinking I was going to be a pro poker player.
Right.
And it turned out to be far more boring than I anticipated.
In what way?
Playing good poker is boring because what it means is 90% of hands you fold right away. Maybe 80% of hands you fold right away.
Yeah.
Most of the hands that you do play out in very routine ways. And you may play one or two hands a day that really require creative strategy. You are basically looking for very predictable patterns in your other players, and exploiting those patterns and playing in a very consistent, not very consistent, but you know how you're supposed to play, and you just sort of play that out, and it's like kind of like becoming a robot in a lot of ways. Now I'm sure at the higher levels, especially in tournament play and at the higher levels, you know, really great poker players, it is a creative, interesting process for them. It would have to be. But for where I was at, the sort of level I was at, I wasn't that good that I could creatively, you know, come up with... every once in a while it would happen where I would realize how someone was playing and realize, oh, he's doing this, which means if I do this, then I can take his money.
Right. Check or chess. Like you were saying,
you were getting one or two moves ahead of somebody. You realized there was one hand where there was a very aggressive guy playing with me, and he was playing he was the guy after me. So he would always get to act right after me, and there was this, we were the next to last card of a particular hand, and he bet. Or I bet, and he raised me, and I really didn't want to call his raise because I didn't have a great hand. But I thought it through, and I was like, I have to call him. And then I thought, you know, if I call him now, I have to call whatever he bets on the river. I can't fold. I'm stuck with the hand. So I spent like 5 minutes deciding whether or not to call. I call. The next card comes up. I check automatically. He bets automatically, and I call immediately.
Yeah.
And it freaked him out. He was like, "What? Why did you call me so fast?" Because I had thought about the previous move for like 3 or 4 minutes.
Yes.
And then the next move, I had already thought through the next move.
Yeah.
Like, he's going to bet no matter what, so I got to call no matter what. No matter what card hits on the river, I have to call.
Yep.
And so he thought the whole thing was a setup. You know, he thought that I had totally fucked with him.
Yes.
And when he was just being kind of an aggressive, I just clued in the fact that he was being an aggressive player, and I just had to call him.
Yeah.
And so every once in a while you would have these sort of insights where with a particular player it's like, oh, when he does this, it almost always means Y, and therefore I can make money off this situation. I should try and find this situation to make money off of him. The other thing, though, which that brings up, which I didn't like in the long run, was it turned you into a predatory kind of mindset.
I see that.
You know, you would go into the casino and you would see, oh my god, look at that guy playing in on table 7. I've played with him before. He's really bad. I love playing with him. And that's, it's very different than sort of going in and going like, where can I find the most competitive game? Like, if you were playing, you know, there would be games, like if you were a Scrabble player or something, you know, you kind of want to play against the best people you could play.
Right.
You don't want to just find somebody to beat.
It's a challenge.
You know, and that's true of most games. In poker, it's like, no, you want to find the richest, stupidest players to play with and exploit them. Yep. And that's not a pleasant mindset to live in, you know?
No.
It's a very different mindset than being an improviser, where it's like, I want to find the most talented and friendly people to challenge me creatively and to create things with.
Right. I
mean, that's an exciting mindset to live in.
Yes.
As a poker player, you know, I had much more fun playing these $5 and $10 tournaments that we would play at the UCB office after classes were done on Tuesday nights. Because,
friendly games, just...
Well, I mean, we took them extremely seriously, but the money that was at stake wasn't that big a deal. That's, I mean, people, you would lose $10 or $5.
That's how my friends and I are. We do that
and,
same thing.
And that was fun, because it was like you were really trying to beat people, and you wanted people to be good, and we would berate people, you know, in a way that you would never in a casino, because we wanted them to be better players, so that it wasn't so easy to beat them.
Yes.
So
it sounds exactly like my every Sunday night.
Right.
Every Sunday night, we do the same exact thing.
That style of poker is really enjoyable to me.
Yeah.
But the kind of poker where you're grinding it out to try and make as much money is just not as enjoyable.
Yeah. Yeah. Man. Yeah. I've been into cards and poker for such a long time, and never have I ever tried to make any money off of it. I've always enjoyed just having fun with it and trying to learn it and having it challenge me. Because I never thought I was lucky enough or I had like the right skill set to do it. But it's kind of funny too, because I'm risky. I'm one of those people that take risks all the time. And, you know, like I'll do that same thing where I'll call somebody immediately and they're like, well, and usually this is where I get called out. And they're like, well, you don't, you know, you have anything depending on if it's, you know, the turn of the river. Usually about the turn of the river, that's when the serious action starts to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, and then I'm kind of like, well, how can I mess with this? I like to slow play. You ever do the slow play?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And you sit there and you just let them simmer and you kind of just play along.
I used to call that hurting the bunnies.
Hurting the bunnies.
Before I knew what really much about poker strategy, it would be when I was playing like stupid games before we learned how to play Hold'em.
Yeah.
It would be, that's how I thought of it. You know, sort of like, okay, I've got a monster hand.
Huh.
There's probably no way I can lose this hand. I'm going to raise, but I'm only going to raise like small amounts to just keep the betting going, just to build the pot.
Yeah.
And I would call that hurting the bunnies. It's a form of slow play. It's a very bad form of slow play in Hold'em.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to just make these little raises and stuff. You want to, because it comes back to bite you very often.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
There were definitely things that you would enjoy. I enjoyed the moment I realized what the sort of mathematical foundation between raising with flush draws and when it was made sense and when it did not.
Yeah.
And it was so fun to realize like, okay, this is the right, this play that looks like I've got a set of threes is the same play that I would make if I've got a flush draw on the flop. And that now I can do both. I can do this play where I'm behind, but I have a very good chance of beating you looks exactly the same as I have you clobbered and you have virtually no chance of beating me, so that when I bet aggressively in that situation, you have to decide, has he got me clobbered or am I ahead but he's got a good chance of beating me?
Yeah.
And neither of those situations feel very comfortable for you.
No.
But you know, I used to be the guy faced with that decision, you know, why is this guy raising with a flush draw, why is this guy raising with a straight draw?
Yeah.
What that seems like such a bad idea. And then when you work out the math of it, it's like, well, if I fold half the time from that raise, then, you know.
Sure. Then you're on the other end of that whole game, really, where you're looking for those bunnies or whatever. And then it's like you give that. I used to call it like a tell, I guess, or you wherever, you know, people can see what you're, when you're giving up or you're changing whatever your strategy is.
Right.
And so I look for that too.
There was the whole idea of it was trying to figure out ways that what you're doing could mean two very different things.
Right.
Instead of, you could be checking because you have a monster hand. You could be checking because you desperately want to get a free card and you're hoping the person behind you won't bet.
Yeah.
You could be raising early on, because you could be check raising because you have aces, you could be check raising because you have ace king, you could be check raising because you have a pair of sevens. You know, this is, and you don't believe the other person is, you know, you, or you're just check raising with nothing,
right?
Because the guy behind you has been raising so much, and you want him to be afraid of you and stop raising you,
right?
So it's a fascinating thing, but only in small amounts. When you're doing it for 8 hours a day, it becomes very boring.
I can only imagine. Similar to improv too. I think sometimes when you're doing improv for all day long, it's like anything you do, as much as you love it, if you do it for long enough, you'll begin to have little things.
No, never. Computer coding I can do for 12 hours a day.
Oh wow.
That was what I was doing with Second Life, and I'm doing it now with our website for the theater company I'm running.
Which is Under the Gun.
Under the Gun Theater, which I Chicago. Started last year with my partner, Angie McMahon.
Yeah. And how's that been going? I hate to say it, we're almost out of time, because this is, so fast. I feel like we just started. I want to talk about that real quick, because I think that's really great that you're doing out there doing that. So how's it going so far?
It's going fine. We basically had 4 productions this year. A variety show that ran for 10 months, an improv tournament called the Under the Gun Improv Classic, which we're going to do again this year, and a show called One Act Roulette, where we wrote one act plays based on improvisations, and then finally Snubfest, which is a festival that Angie has run for years and years, a festival for stand-up and storytelling and solo sketch and all this other stuff.
I love that.
And so it's been doing all right. You know, we've been doing classes and so forth, and we're looking to expand in this coming fall. Yeah. And so I've been working for the last month and a half every day revamping the website to do all these things sort of automatically, make it much easier for people to register for classes or buy tickets for a show, or make it much easier for us to check them in when they get to the show. Yeah. All this kind of building a whole website system from scratch.
Absolutely.
Which is insane.
Yeah. I know nothing about that. Like, that is the furthest away from anything. I know nothing about coding or HTTP. What is it?
HTML.
That's the one. I don't know. I don't know any of that.
That's like the easiest. That's like WordPerfect.
Yep. Don't know any of that.
HTML is easy peasy.
Yeah. I was never, I don't know, I never got into computers or that side of it. Like, I like to play video games, but I never even, like, I never had the desire to even want to create video games or test video. You know how at some point in your life, you're like, all I want to do is sit and play video games all day, and it's like, nah, I get bored.
Yeah.
I'm too, I don't know.
I think there's a big difference between making video games and playing them.
Sure.
Whenever I have had the chance to sort of get on the other side of that, where I'm creating something inside of using a computer, it's been much more absorbing than simply playing a game.
Right.
Although I get totally absorbed by that as well. So, way too many hours grinding up characters in Warcraft.
Sucked right in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Well, we are pretty much to the end now, and I'm super sad because I know there is a plethora of information and stories and things. I mean, we didn't even tap into a lot of the improv stuff, but that's okay, because I think that,
been covered in a lot of other places.
Exactly. Like, I know that people can find that about you anywhere, and I love talking to you about real life stuff and things like that are interesting, because I find it fascinating to get to know people in that regard. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
The last thing that I always do is I always flip the script on it a little bit and offer out any questions if you want to ask me a question or two or anything. I know that seems kind of like a weird way to be like, all right, there we go.
Well, so you work in a kitchen.
I do.
And is that something you went to school with, or is it something you just sort of worked your way up through a kitchen?
Yep, I picked it up along the way. Boy Scouts is actually where I learned to, I taught myself how to cook.
Okay.
My very first experience cooking, I burnt macaroni and cheese. And from that point on, I vowed to never make another bad meal again. That is not a vow I've kept, but it is something that I found very true, because I had to become self-reliant very early on. My mother wasn't there. She had to work, so she wasn't there to take care of me necessarily, and my stepfather had odd hours. He worked at a car factory, plant, whatever Ford, or no, he works for Ford now. He was working for DuPont at the time. So weird hours, all kinds of crazy stuff. And so I had to become really self-reliant, and I just kind of started teaching myself how to do these things, but I wanted to make them better each time. So,
and if you were creating a meal to impress a lady, like what would be your go-to, like, okay, I got, this will be, this will be the...
I hate to say it, but...
You got
to
reveal.
Italian?
Like, sure, of course.
I don't know. People just have this thing for Italian food, and I am all about spices, especially anything that's got Italian spices with, like thyme, and there's, basil. Oh, I love basil. What else? Parsley. I mean, all of those green spices. Of course, garlic. Garlic is, like, my jam. I mean, that stuff is... Oof. I put it in everything.
Sure. So you... Stuffer full of garlic.
Stuffer full of garlic, which is probably not the the most efficient way or best way of impressing a woman and being like, all right, well, here's all this garlic now. Let's, you know, da da da. But no, I think I love to make a nice red sauce. And I don't use like spaghetti. I use like a penne or something like that, just a little bit different. I don't know. Yeah, there's always. And I like working with oils as well. Any kind of like oil, olive oil, canola oil. Things of that nature. So garlic bread, I mean, carbs is the way to anyone's heart. I feel like that's, you know, you can't go wrong. It's just not possible. Even like this morning, you know, watching my friends eat bagels, and it's just like carb overload, and I'm like, okay, yeah, carbs is the way. So yeah, definitely, I've made many Italian meal and won over many American girl.
There you go.
But I cook burgers on the regular.
Sure.
So well,
that's a staple of manhood.
Yeah. Yeah. Just meat and potatoes. But not a lot of women like that meat and potatoes. There's a romance to it. If I could cook more French, I know that sounds really weird to say cook more French, but like if I could like incorporate their sense of flair and like panache with the food that they serve and have, I think I would have a whole nother facet. And and that's even something with like if you take French but also look into like Creole and Cajun and those kind of, and that's like you're getting spicy, you're getting into the you know crawdads and jambalayas, and which I have not dabbled with, but I'm curious because there's just so much again spice that goes along with all that. And I'm big into Mediterranean. I like curry. I like cumin. I'm all over the world with my eating habits and cooking habits. So, yeah. Kind of just that's my fun little hobby. It's not that thing like I could probably cook all day long because I do cook all day long, but then I still go home and cook more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's that thing. That's me coding, cooking.
That's your coding.
That's my coding. It's cooking. Yeah, yeah. Cool. Yeah. Well, that's it. I think we got what we needed, and I know that I would love to sit here and talk to you all day and ask you way more questions, but we've got regular non-second lives to live.
I have to get out of this apartment that I'm apparently allergic to.
I know. I'm so sorry. Your allergies are terrible. So, but thank you again very much. It's been wonderful hanging out with you and getting to know you, and I know that we'll continue to, you know, build the friendship and of course, you know, be able to work together and everything. So I wish you the best of luck and with everything in Chicago. That's so great. I love that there's so many more opportunities now for people to go to different places other than just like the staples, you know, like branch out, live a little. So awesome. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Zach.
Thanks.